This is the lecture for week six about land as a commons and water as a commons. The themes we're going to talk about today are: what does it mean to treat land as private property, and what does it mean to treat land as a commons, and how do those ideas conflict or how are they compatible? We're also going to talk about the justifications of private property rights and land and some of the ways that people have asserted that the community has legitimate and powerful interest in how private property and land is used. This will include an overview of people like Aldo Leopold, Wendell Berry, and the public trust doctrine. We'll move on from that to some of Eric Freifogel's book, The Land We Share, which is a wonderful history of private property and land and the efforts to limit that and assert certain community interests in land. And after talking about land, we'll move on to enclosures of water, which is one of the more vexing problems of our time, as lots of private companies, some of them multinationals, try to claim ownership of fresh water, be it in groundwater or rivers and lakes. You have multinational companies trying to convert lots of publicly available water into bottled water with huge markups, essentially turning a common good into a proprietary private good at our expense. And then we're going to close with a look at some of the successful water commonses, where communities have successfully managed their water systems, either municipal water supplies or rivers and lakes, or the famous Acequia system in New Mexico and southern Colorado, which has been in existence for centuries as a way to manage water in a way that is accessible and equitable for lots of people in a region that is very arid and there's very little water to share. So let's start with Eric Freifogel's book, The Land We Share, which is a terrific overview of this history of how we've treated land. A lot of people today think that land, a property right in land, is an absolute right, that it's mine, God damn it, and I don't want anybody to do anything against my private property. But the truth of the matter is that property rights have always been limited in some fashion, if only because landowners can create nuisances for adjacent property owners. And so there's an inherent limit in one's property right to the extent that there's lots of people that have property rights and they come into conflict. Now, government is often called upon to mediate these disputes and determine what the scope of one's land property rights ought to be. The problem is that many landowners conceive of their interests purely in monetary terms, investment terms, whereas government is trying to maximize the collective value of property rights and land. And this can mean not just the investment cash value of land, but the long-term ecological interests in land so that habitat can flourish and ecosystems can function well. As well as the long-term social interests of a community, so that, for example, investors can't simply rip and run with the resources and leave the community in a desperate shape. So the problem is that private property right owners frequently want short-term, individualized monetary value of land to be the paramount value and to trump all other property right entitlements, to trump community entitlements. This has coalesced into a movement in the past several decades, often called the takings movement, because these property right owners claim that the government is taking their property when they enact environmental laws or zoning laws or other rules that might restrict how the property owner can use their land, his land. And under the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, it's unconstitutional to take a land or take someone's property without due compensation. these property owners are claiming that that's what the government's doing when it tries to protect the environment or zone, or in other ways, look out for the long-term community interests. So there's a pitched political struggle going on that's being played out largely in the courts, sometimes in the legislatures, about the proper scope of property rights. But if you look at the history of property law, you see that private property has always been a social institution and not a natural right. Some people like to say if it's a natural right, well then, you know, there's no messing around with it because it's something that exists beyond any particular legislature or culture. But the truth is, even if you have natural property rights as some matter of natural law, you still need legislatures and courts to enforce those rights. So you're back to square one in the sense that property is a community-mediated resource that legislatures and courts have a perfectly legitimate right to define how it should function. And indeed, in American history, there are the founding fathers saw private property as something beholden to communities. Franklin said that private property is, quote, a creature of society, and as such is subject to the calls of that society whenever its necessities shall require it, even to its last farthing. And Jefferson had great disdain for speculators and land barons while other citizens went landless. He saw the inequality as something that ought to be addressed. And it's worth even going back to Locke, who is often cited by property rights advocates. Locke said that nobody had an entitlement to so much property that it might spoil, and that he assumed as well that there was a property good enough for all. So he assumed a sort of a fictional scenario in which there were really no limits on land. But of course, we know that land is finite and it can be used up. So we have to come to terms with the fact that property exists in a community context and that the community has legitimate rights to see how that property is used. Now, historically, some of the more common ways that property has been restricted are wildlife. You can't have a private entitlement to wildlife. The state acts as a trustee for wildlife, and it's collectively owned. The same for fish in navigable waters. There's something called the public trust doctrine, which allows us to have access to beaches and lakefronts for recreational purposes so that private property owners cannot totally restrict access to those bodies of water. And historically, the public has had a right to forage on unenclosed lands. So there are all sorts of ways in which private property is not an absolutely held right. Now, there have been many justifications for private ownership of land over time. The earliest ones were really, I got here first, and therefore I'm entitled to claim it all. And this became a more problematic notion when more people might arrive in a region, and the fact that one person got there first and didn't necessarily do anything to improve the land, why should he be entitled? So this a successor theory that has more often been cited is the labor theory of value that John Locke articulated, where if you mix your labor with the resource, in this case the land, and make it productive, for example, by farming, you're thereby entitled to what is resulting. This one, of course, has a great popularity and continues to this day to be a justification for why someone might be entitled to own some property. Then you have the personality theory, which is often cited in cultural or creative contexts, where a creative work, a book, a piece of music, a film, is an expression of one's personality, and therefore one is entitled to it by that reason. But really the strongest and most often used justification today is one of overall social utility. By granting individual property rights, It allows people to make stable, secure investments and anticipate predictable outcomes over time. And this encourages market activity, market investment, and we're all made better by this kind of commerce and development. And that's a very persuasive theory, but there are some elements of the common good that even here are not met by private property and markets. For example, markets don't usually create parks or protect wilderness. That's something that's a public good that governments usually have to create. And markets don't often allow for public deliberation. All you can do is vote with your dollars. And markets often tend to produce great inequality, which public and governmentally organized efforts can help ameliorate. And then finally, public values tend to shift over time, whereas property law tends to be more stable and almost inert. It's very difficult to change property law norms. So there's a good case to be made for public values to be expressed through government and not just through private property rights. You know, it's important to realize that over time, even under the utilitarian justification for property rights, over time, our needs and values change. 200 years ago, there was a great need to spur development and to build up capital improve things. And nature was regarded as essentially limitless and indestructible. So there was a good rationale for saying that property should be privileged to develop so that it could, so more capital could be created, and so greater commerce and technological progress and settlements could develop. This was a way of maximizing value. But of course, as we see today, a lot of this out-of-control market activity is not creating value necessarily. It's destroying natural value in the earth. And so there is a legitimate need today to find new ways to limit these claims of absolute property rights to do whatever the hell you want with your land. Now, a major figure in some of these debates about the proper scope of property law is Henry George. In the late 1800s, he published a very influential book called Progress and Poverty. And among other things, it made the claim that the rising value of land really ought to belong to the community itself and not to the landowner. Because after all, what did the landowner do to improve the value of that land? He might have built a building and improved that, and indeed he should be entitled to any increases of value of that building. But the land itself was there from the start, and if there is more traffic that goes by it and more people that consider it valuable, or if a city builds roads or subways or other civic infrastructure nearby that makes the land more valuable, did the landowner do anything to be entitled to that? Probably not. So Henry George made the claim that really appreciation of value in land is something that ought to go to the community. And the way he proposed doing that was levying a single tax on land so that any appreciation of land, the money could go to the community to finance all sorts of things. And of course, landlords could reap the value of their buildings and any improvements to them. This innovative idea gave rise to actually a social movement at the time and was quite influential. And it has been influential, especially in Europe. But in America, it never really did catch hold, and we have adopted the more individualistically oriented approach to land, and essentially speculators are able to reap the increase of value of land, even though the public, through the form of government investment in infrastructure, roads, bridges, subways, are often the ones creating the additional value to that land. Today, Georgists, as they're called, are still around, and they're a pretty opinionated, single-minded bunch, and I still think they've got a very good idea. But and in fact, it's a great idea for helping to arrest the scourge of sprawl sprawled development. Because if you did have a single tax on land, investors would have more incentive to build better buildings and not simply speculate on land, which has resulted in sprawling land development and land use in the United States. In any case, the Georgist episode highlights how there are often great political contests over who should have the rights to the future development of land, the future value of development. Who owns that? And I mentioned the takings movement. That's largely what the takings movement is all about. Freifogel, in his book, cites a interesting example of an apartment complex across from the National Zoo, which had a big lawn, and its owners decided they wanted to sell that lawn for building purposes and have other investors build houses or apartments. Well, because it was a historic district, it was something that had to be reviewed, and there was a great controversy over whether the owners of that plot of land should be absolutely entitled to do with it what they want, or whether the surrounding community had an entitlement. Again, it comes down to who has the right to monetize the future earnings from that land. Is it necessarily wrapped up in the property right, or should property owners simply recognize that laws change over time, and that's one of the risks of owning land, just like there's a risk attendant to owning stock? It's an unresolved question that keeps recurring in our political culture. One problem, though, is that landowners frequently externalize costs onto other people, sometimes the general public, sometimes ecosystems nearby, and sometimes ecosystems quite a distance away. They can have too much development that will reduce biodiversity and habitat for species. They can destroy watersheds that are important to the purity of water. They can destroy the soil and crop fertility. They can erode the hydrologic cycle, the cycle that water goes through from land to earth and then back up into the air. And they can destroy the aesthetics of the landscape. These are all externalities that a landowner might create but really pay no price for doing so. So this is something that the property rights advocates often overlook. A major figure in the history of property law and its community implications is Aldo Leopold, who was a great conservationist and ecologist in the 30s and 40s. He wrote a book called A Sand County Almanac in 1949, which set forward the idea of a land ethic, a philosophy of a land ethic. His idea was that land is not just an object that's inert and separate from us. It's something that is part of people and culture and other parts of nature. So it's not just dead soil that we can do with what we want. And he thought that economics ought to be conjoined with ethics and aesthetics. And we have to realize that land is also about community. Now, this represents a rather stiff challenge to American notions of individualism, but he was on to something very profound that we continue to grapple with today, which is how do we integrate our culture and ecosystems with our notions of private property in land? His idea was a land ethic, in which he said, a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. The core problem is that people see themselves as distinct from nature, and they feel free to treat nature as an object and abuse it. And land thereby loses its ability to sustain life after this goes on for a while. And this could be contrasted with the gift economy ethic that Native Americans tended to show towards land, where they often had elaborate rituals to show their gratitude to nature when salmon came in the spring or when other resources showed their plenitude. And so there was built into their culture was a whole attitude and worldview of respect for the limits of nature, which is something that market culture has had great trouble trying to develop. Leopold pointed out that individual land use works against sound conservation, because essentially the positive externalities that an individual might generate from taking care of his land properly accrues to everybody else as a public good. So one individual landowner might make great sacrifices for the community and for future generations, and everybody else can just be a free rider on that. And so it's kind of difficult from the perspective of an individual to develop sound conservation practices. For a while, Leopold entertained the idea of economic incentives or payments to help incentivize landowners to behave properly and try to conserve land. But he realized that after a while that that didn't work very well to actually sustain forests and protect wildlife and water and conserve soil, because it was going to bankrupt government. And it didn't necessarily encourage people to adopt the right attitudes themselves. Today, this argument is often made, the term used is nature's services, that nature provides all sorts of services on which we can put a price tag for bees who pollinate flowers and crops, and the service that wetlands do in keeping water pure. And therefore, we ought to compensate landowners for some of these resources for nature services. Again, the problem is it doesn't cultivate the ethic, and it's going to bankrupt the government. Ultimately, Leopold saw that if we want to make certain elements of nature inalienable to the market, we have to develop a different ethic, the land ethic. And that's where the commons comes in, because it helps. The commons is also about generating a shared social ethic in conjunction with the resource. You're not just a consumer with a cash relationship to a vendor, and all that matters is the transaction. You have a longer standing set of relationships that are moral, social, ecological. Leopold wrote, there's a great quote that encapsulates this idea that he wrote about. He said, "We have not asked the citizen to assume any real responsibilities. We have told him that if he will vote right, obey the law, join some organizations, and practice conservation, what conservation is profitable on his own land, that everything will be lovely. The government will do the rest." But then he said, "No important change in human conduct is ever accomplished without an internal change in our intellectual emphases, our loyalties, our affections, and our convictions." And this is something that the market really has had trouble cultivating, because the market ethic rewards the monetary performance, but it doesn't cultivate a larger ethic of stewardship for the long term. And this point is driven home by another major figure in property law and ecological economics, Wendell Berry. He's written a great deal in a very lyrical but profound way about how one takes care of land for the long term. And his notion is that we are embedded in the land, both as individuals and as communities, and we have to learn how to take seriously the particularities of the land and develop a localized knowledge of a stretch of land, and that this is the way to develop the proper land ethic. Because in the market, everyone is focused on their individual self-gain, self-benefit, usually for the short term, and that the price system encourages us to regard things as substitutable and fungible. If one piece of land is worth $100,000 and another is worth $100,000, well, they're essentially interchangeable, when in fact they may have profoundly different roles in the ecosystem and shouldn't simply be treated as interchangeable by the market. For Wendell Berry, the community is the ultimate source of value, not the individual. Again, swimming upstream against American culture. Wendell Berry and similar commentators have pointed out that the market can't be the best measure of the value of land for a number of reasons. One, as I've mentioned, there's the pressure toward short-term competitive performance tends to undermine the long-term stewardship of the land. And even the market tends to have imperfect information about the real costs and consequences of things. The price doesn't reflect the actual value of the land. Does it reflect, you know, the role that the wildlife and the microorganisms and the wetlands play? Very often it doesn't. Wetlands are regarded as swamps that are worth nothing, so we can destroy them safely because the market doesn't value them properly. And so there's this mismatch between what the market regards as valuable and what the ecosystem, which is very complex and not fully understood, might regard as valuable. Which is precisely why the market tends to displace many costs onto others or onto nature without properly internalizing that cost into price. And there's some question philosophically about whether price can ever be a subtle enough information signal of the true value of an ecosystem. I mean, we're talking about moral, ecological, even spiritual value to land. Can a price represent that? Now, it's worth recalling Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons thesis in this context. Hardin's highly abstract model of the Tragedy of the Commons, in which individuals overexploited the land and ruined it, assumed that there were no externalities, that nothing was going from the given commons into adjacent properties. Yet, of course, in real life, this happens all the time. And Hardin didn't take account of the fact that if you have a fragmentation of rights and responsibilities for managing the land, because there's all these private property rights, that it makes it harder to do comprehensive land planning, and lots of inefficiencies like sprawl result. And there's higher transaction costs among the property owners in acquiring information and coordinating plans when there's a fragmentation. And it's harder to identify sources of problems, say pollution, when the land is so, when ownership is so fragmented. So in truth, you know, a commons can often perform quite well in taking care of these problems because it brings them all within a community governance system rather than displacing them onto other people. It applies restraints. Freifogel points out the challenge in a wonderful quote by sociologist Christopher Lash. He says, "A public philosophy for the 21st century will have to give more weight to the community than to the right of private decision. It will have to emphasize responsibilities rather than rights. It will have to find a better expression of the community than the welfare state. It will have to limit the scope of the market and the power of corporations without replacing them with a centralized state bureaucracy." Well, there's much more that can and should be said about land, but this is a nice introduction to some of the major themes about the ownership of land. Let's move on to water and the many problems there. Water is such a special, one might even say unique resource in that it's essential to all of life and it flows everywhere. It can't be easily controlled. You can put it in a cup and say, "This is mine," but then you dump it into the water and it's off into the world. And so the very idea of asserting private property rights in water is often, should be seen as kind of an absurdity. Yet the market has found its ways and insists upon, in many instances, owning water. Now, it's hard to talk about water in a unified way because there are so many arenas in which water flows and is governed by different bodies of law. You have drinking water, you have groundwater, you have rivers and lakes and oceans. You have recreational access to water. You have the pollution of water. So obviously these intersect and overlap, but they're also different and require different approaches to governance. There's different bodies of law for each. But one thing that is quite clear is that in all of these areas, there are numerous pressures from the market to enclose the water, to privatize it, to claim ownership for it at the expense of ecosystems and of communities. One of the more infamous examples of this is the case of Bolivia, where several years ago, the World Bank collaborated with the Bechtel Corporation to gain rights to private to municipal water systems in Bolivia. And this was an aggressive attempt to privatize access to water, to make it water a commodity from which profit would be wrung. And this has been a fairly recent development in the history of water, where historically it has been treated as a community resource and communities have controlled their water systems, for example. However, in the past 10 or 20 years, large multinational companies have seen that as water becomes clean water, drinkable water becomes scarcer, there's money to be made in trying to claim the bottlenecks that control that water. And municipal water systems are one perfect example of that. Well, Bechtel's entry into Bolivia resulted in much, much higher prices for people who had very little spendable cash in the first place. Yet, of course, you need money to live. It resulted in huge riots and civil unrest. And eventually, because of that, and after several deaths, Bechtel retreated, left Bolivia, and the community was left to try to pick up the pieces and devise their own ways to manage the water. In truth, they need the renovations of infrastructure for water, the capital, but they also need affordable access, and that is the challenge that exists in many places around the world today, not just in the Global South, but in the United States as well. Maud Barlow of Canada, with the Council of Canadians, has been a leading international activist in this area. And two years ago, she produced a real landmark report called Our Water Commons Towards a New Freshwater Narrative. And she was attempting to show how the commons is a way to understand how water can be managed in a fair and equitable and sustainable way. Much of her report focused on the many enclosures going on and how communities are being exploited whenever water is treated as a profitable commodity. People need the water. They don't necessarily have the money. They need improvements in water infrastructure. They often don't have the capital to do it, and companies are preying upon that need when they try to take equity ownership and possession of those resources. A common thing going on in many townships and cities around the United States is the temptation to sell municipal water systems to private companies because their city budgets are so besieged that they see it as the only way to continue to provide water. They're essentially selling their crown jewels because they're so desperate. The problem with these privatized arrangements is the companies are not trying to do a favor for those citizens. They're out to make money off of it. And so they lay off public employees, cut corners on quality, scrimp on capital investment, shortchange long-term planning and investment, and are less concerned about pollution. They're more willing to cut off water supplies to people who don't pay their bills, which are often quite higher as a result of the private ownership of the water systems. When profit is the chief criterion for investment in new water infrastructure, poor people and poor countries are the last to get water. And one key concern of the water justice movement is that water should be a human right, not something that is available only to those who can afford it. The problem is water is becoming scarcer. Humans use half of the Earth's accessible runoff water, and this is declining all the time. Maud Barlow points out that there are five major sources of enclosure of water and which are serving to reduce the amount of water in the hydrologic cycle. One is aquifer mining. More groundwater is being pumped more quickly than it can be replenished, which is depleting huge amounts of water. There is pipeline diversions and bulk transport of water from one place to another, sometimes halfway around the globe, from the northern regions of Canada, say, to Saudi Arabia or Arizona. You have climate change, which is evaporating a lot of surface waters and melting glaciers. You have cities which are serving as urban heat islands because there's so much concrete and built architecture. The ecosystem can't work properly and water is not retained, and it's hotter besides. And then you have what's called the virtual water trade, where there is so much water embedded in agricultural products, food, that the exports of corn, say, from Mexico represents a huge transfer of water from one ecosystem to another continent sometimes. So this erosion of the hydrologic cycle is something that is of great concern. Essentially, the hydrologic cycle is being cannibalized and enclosed, and we need to regard it as a commons. Rainwater has to be allowed to restore ecosystems and groundwater and watersheds, and cannot simply be diverted and privatized for market purposes alone. There needs to be a greater attention towards this shared aspect of water and its ability to flow wherever it can. We see this problem most conspicuously with bottled water, which is simply the rank privatization of a public resource. In the 1970s, there was only about 1 billion liters of bottled water sold annually. In 2007, there was more than 2,000 billion liters, or about 500 billion gallons. The bottled water industry is growing at the rate of 10% a year, and it imposes huge price markups for very, very little value added. In many instances, the water quality is only as good or worse than municipal water systems provide. Yet these systems, the industry makes a huge amount of money. The four largest bottled water companies make an estimated $100 billion annually. And the tragedy of it is it's often so needless. You have the spectacle of companies like Coca-Cola going into places like India and Chiapas, Mexico, and draining the groundwater, something that has been there for centuries and something that really belongs to the community. A terrific book on this, by the way, is Elizabeth Reut's Bottle Mania, which describes the many waterfronts in which the privatization of water is occurring. Now, what are the effects of treating water as a market commodity? Well, one, it siphons away hundreds of billions of public dollars to private investors and accelerates the decline of public water systems. It encourages short-term profits over long-term stewardship. It fosters market concentration and the dominance of large corporations who not only control access to water, but dominate our political system more than citizens. And in this respect, it also limits citizen rights and accountability over water management, because citizens are turned into consumers and have less of a say-so and points of accountability for how water is managed. And the bottom line problem is in the enclosure of water treats water as alienable, something that can be sold and put into the market. And the problem, as mentioned earlier, is price doesn't adequately capture the actual value of water, especially when these markets are not open and competitive. But then there's other reasons as well. Three consequences of commodifying water is there's no incentive to conserve water or stop water pollution, because the private market regimes finds it can get away with it, and regulatory agencies that might stop it are often challenged in courts or with complex scientific data and battles there. In other words, there's no effective counterforce through regulatory agencies to stop the many abuses of water. And also the rise of new cleanup technologies are decreasing the incentive to clean up the source of the pollution, because there's money to be made from externalizing the pollution in the first place, and then money to be made from selling technologies to clean it up. So you get these really perverse incentives going on. A second reason that commodifying water is bad is who's going to buy water for ecosystem survival? Nature doesn't have any money to spend, and so its interests are constantly shortchanged by the market. Markets don't know how to limit their extraction and use of scarce water supplies, and market forces, corporations, constantly are acting to try to erode the ability of government to protect water sources and put limits on market activity. And that's why we have the draining of groundwater aquifers. That's why we have the despoilation of water quality, pollution, and so forth. This is being aggravated by the growth of urban markets that are thirsty for water and are increasingly reaching out their arms through the market to exploit rural water sources and to develop global transport systems for water. So you have market pressure for huge ecological disruptions and dispossession of communities of their long-held water. It's a battle that is really occurring in many areas, which I'll get to in a moment. And then the third problem of the commodification of water is that only the rich will have clean water, and this really is a flagrant violation of human rights. Should markets be able to determine who will have water and who will die? As it is, about 1.4 billion people have little or no access to clean drinking water every day. It raises the spectacle of rich agribusiness interests who are raising crops or livestock having a disproportionate share of water, while individuals and communities go thirsty because they don't have the same market power as the huge users. Now, all of these injustices and abuses of the environment are being increasingly challenged by a growing international water justice movement that is working to protest these enclosures and to assert that water is a commons. You have all sorts of water keepers, river keepers, bay keepers type movements. You have lots of indigenous movements. In India, the Rajendra Singh's Taran Bharat Sangh movement has, in the very arid region of Rajasthan, has brought back to life some five rivers by helping mobilize the women, who are chiefly the ones responsible for fetching and protecting the water, mobilizing them to build reservoirs to capture rainwater and to replenish the underwater sources of water. And over time, the rivers returned. It's really a stunning example of how a community mobilization and a commons that enlists people to participate and to show their commitment to the resource can help rejuvenate it in a way that regulatory agencies and government, with their technocratic means, are often simply unable to do. Rajendra Singh has been pointed out as has been called a Gandhi of water activism in India because of the almost miraculous results that he has achieved with his community leadership and the community action to bring back water. And it's a lesson that a lot of people in the United States and other regions of the world are trying to emulate in imagining what it means to manage one's water as a commons. The city of Milwaukee is currently grappling with this question of how do we treat our water as a commons? How do we enlist everybody to see that the water does mean something to them, that they do have a role to play, and that they do have an entitlement to the benefits of their involvement? Maud Barlow says that the real long-term challenge facing us is how do we construct viable commonses to manage water? And she identified 10 principles for doing this. Broad principles that don't self-actualize but can help point the way in the right direction. One is we all own and steward our water. It should not be a market resource. It'd be something that we should collectively manage. Two, she calls for earth democracy. The earth has rights too. We have to more affirmatively recognize that the ecosystems have a need for water, and we have to respect that. The market cannot be the sole arbiter. Related to that is water sustainability and conservation. We have to take affirmative steps to assure that water is not wasted and depleted. The hydrologic cycle has to be preserved as a commons. Related to this, too, is watershed protection. We have to realize that watersheds are an organic ecological fact that need protecting, and that their disruption with pipelines and dams undermine the sustainability of watersheds. So bioregionalism is an important principle for us to respect. We have to see that mountains act as water towers of the world. They hold and retain water, and so we have to more visibly understand this and act accordingly. A fifth principle is community control. Management has to be scalable based on the size of the water resource, and so it's the principle of subsidiarity, meaning control at the lowest feasible level ought to be the operative principle. Sixth, we need water sovereignty for both communities and nations. While, of course, water belongs to the entire planet and circulates, there should not be huge diversions of water for national strategic purposes or market purposes. The water should be allowed to flow naturally within political jurisdictions and not forcibly be shifted. Seventh, we need water justice and human rights. We need to see that women and indigenous peoples' rights are they're the ones hurt the most by much of the marketization of water. And the World Bank's projects which try to privatize water and reduce access to water are really inflicting great social injustices on large classes of people. We need public delivery and fair pricing of water. One way to do this is, you know, while water always will have a price because there are actual costs in protecting and delivering water, we shouldn't treat water as a commodity just because it has a price. And one way to avoid this is something called block rate pricing, where low levels of consumption to meet basic needs of households, for example, are based at a very low price, and that the more you pay, especially bulk users, or the more you use, especially bulk users, the more you have to pay. So industry that is using water for bulk commercial purposes should pay a proportionately higher price for their water. And this both encourages conservation and prevents price gouging, the speculation and trafficking in water through the market. Ninth, water as a right needs to be enshrined in all sorts of global covenants and constitutions that have teeth, and it has to be enforced by good governance. This, of course, is a larger problem around the world of corruption, nepotism, incompetence, bad governance, lack of democracy, but that's something that is wrapped up in the proper stewardship of water. And tenth, we need to use and expand the public trust doctrine, which is a very useful legal tool within United States law, state-based law, to protect public access and use of water. And this is a doctrine that has evolved over time, especially the past 40 years. It's something we have to keep track of and continue to try to develop. There's a closing line that Maude Barlow cites in her report, where she cites South African environmentalist Cormac Cullinan, who said, The day will come when the failure of our laws to recognize the right of a river to flow, to prohibit acts that destabilize the Earth's climate, or to impose a duty to respect the intrinsic value and right to exist of all life, will be as reprehensible as allowing people to be bought and sold. That nicely sums up the challenge we have in trying to reorient, reconceptualize our relationship with water, to see it as something that really is almost sacred, certainly sacred to the possibility of life on Earth, in that while there are certain legitimate market uses of water, we need to be very mindful of the dangers of that as well, and that the unfettered market management and control of water is a very dangerous and unjust way of managing water. That concludes my brief overview of the enclosures of water, and it doesn't conclude it. I need to mention some of the successful water commons. And I will just mention the acequia system in New Mexico as just an exemplary way that water has been managed as a commons for centuries. In that region, some traditions that were pioneered by the Moorish Spain and Spaniards and by the Native Americans of the United States collectively worked together to manage the very scarce water supplies in New Mexico. And they essentially had ditches that were common ditches with different tributaries that would flow to different fields. And collectively, the community would keep the ditches clean and have designated allocations of that water. And there were many specific and strict prohibitions about how one could use the water. You couldn't pollute it, or wash your clothes in it, and many other things to maintain both the quality of it as well as the flow. But it wasn't as if it was possessed totally individually, because they allowed the water to flow as part of nature and, for example, not build earthen or concrete ditches to maintain every last drop, because they wanted the seepage to allow the ecosystem to flourish so that trees could grow and that, as a result, protect the fields from the wind, which would not blow off the soil. In other words, by treating the ecosystem as a unitary whole and respecting the need for the ecosystem to have access to water and to function according to its own natural imperatives, they could better protect the water over time instead of treating it simply as a commodity, the way the market is inclined to do. The acequia communities have very developed systems for of social participation, of debate, of transparency, so they identify anybody who's abusing the water, and community rituals and celebrations. Every year, there are days in which everybody in the community has a responsibility to help dig out the muck from the ditches so that they can flow smoothly and cleanly. And this is also a celebration and a sort of a rebonding with the water. This communal use of acequia water has frequently come into conflict with traditional housing developers or other people who want the water for their own private purposes in New Mexico. And so there's an interesting struggle between those who assert a market control and those who assert a collective control. But the acequia community has at least two things going for it. One, it has been around for centuries, managing the resource of water sustainably. And second, it was there first. And I suppose there's a third as well, that unlike many regions where water is managed collectively, the New Mexico state law formally recognizes the acequia system as a way to manage water. So fortunately, it's a fairly established system with great cultural and legal backing behind it. But nonetheless, because water is so scarce, there are constant challenges to the acequia, the members of acequias, because others, of course, want that water, those water rights, to try to make money. there are many other attempts to try to impose common-based principles for the management of water, where communities, for example, are reclaiming the privatized municipal water systems and reestablishing it under mutual ownership systems as opposed to private equity ownership systems. But these are a struggle that is really just beginning, because the idea of conceptualizing water as a commons is as opposed to a government-owned resource or a privately-owned resource is a fairly new battle. And much of the future will be about seeing how specific institutions, legal structures, and cultural practices can evolve that will allow people to see that they have a connection to the water and the resource, and therefore not only enjoy equitable benefits from it, but show responsibility and stewardship in managing the water more than either the market or government agencies often provide today. So with that, I conclude, and next week we will talk about the atmosphere as a commons and Peter Barnes's writing in this area, Who Owns the Sky and Capitalism 3.0.